Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. A return to normalcy today, two guests in two segments. Anatole Levin will try to make sense of Biden's foreign policy as a whole, and Lily Lynch will talk about the emptying out of the Balkans. Joe Biden's foreign policy has been consistently and impressively bellicose, aggressively supporting wars in Ukraine and the Middle East and amping up tensions with China. And his anointed successor, who has something like a 50-50 chance of succeeding him, looks to be following suit. Many people have read Kamala Harris's courting of endorsements from the Cheneys, the Liz and Dick of our times, as mere pragmatic electioneering, but they're far from the only neocons to endorse her. Over 100 former Republican foreign policy officials, including the odious John Negroponte, who had a large hand in running Reagan's wars in Central America in the 1980s, and George W.'s CIA director, Michael Hayden, who did a lot of warrantless wiretapping when he ran the National Security Agency, signed a letter endorsing Harris last month out of concern that Trump would be a poor empire manager. Another endorser, Bush's Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who provided legal opinions that justified torture. And, as Aida Chavez noted in The Intercept, a section from the 2020 Democratic platform on ending forever wars and opposing regime change was completely removed in 2024. The people who brought you the Iraq War are back. These endorsements have been applauded by lots of liberals as a political victory for Harris, but the policy implications are alarming. It is, however, a return home for the neocons, many of whom were Democrats, the party that gave us the CIA, NATO, and the Vietnam War. Here's Behind the News regular Anatole Levin to make sense of it all. Anatole is director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. In the 1980s and 90s, he covered the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and the wars in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and the Southern Caucasus for the Financial Times and the Times of London. Anatole Levin. I want to talk about each of the hot spots in the world in turn, but I want to start with a general discussion. The Biden administration's foreign policy just seems extremely bellicose, and sometimes even surprises me how bellicose it is. Maybe, I don't know, is it a wounded animal striking out, or is there some greater logic behind this? What is the strategy that is fueling this appetite for multiple wars and confrontations?
Basically, the whole of the American foreign and security establishment and the greater part of the political establishment, not all, I mean, there are dissidents on the right and left, essentially signed up to what used to be called the Wolfowitz Doctrine from the memo of 1992, which set out that the US should pursue and enforce permanent hegemony, not just in the world as a whole, but in every region of the world. This, as wise people pointed out at the time, meant that the US would inevitably come into conflict with a range of other states around the world who were never going to be prepared to allow the United States to dominate them and their regions in this way. Because the Wolfowitz Doctrine also said two things. It said that no state would have any influence beyond its borders except that which was in the interests of the United States and allowed by the United States. And it also said that the US had the right, and indeed the duty, to change the internal policies and systems of the states in accordance with its wishes. And as some people pointed out at the time, this was basically an attempt to extend a hard version of the Monroe Doctrine, in other words, not a defensive version, but an interventionist version, to the whole planet. And yes, I mean, this was bound to lead to tension and even conflict wherever major countries had interests, vital interests, differing from those of the United States. But by a strange process of, I don't know, intellectual and cultural transformation, but with deep roots in American history, this has effectively become the ruling doctrine of both American political parties, because it's the ruling doctrine of the foreign and security elites on whom they draw for their senior officials.
32 years ago, or whatever it was, the U.S. had more standing in the world, more economic standing, more cultural standing, more political standing than it does now. It was impossibly insanely grandiose back then, but it seems even more so now.
Well, I think that's right. And oddly enough, two things have come together. One is that the very, very brief in historical terms, unipolar moment from the end of the Cold War to when Iraq started going badly wrong or the financial recession of 2008. In any case, less than 20 years has been now taken as the norm from which everything else is an illegitimate and strange and unacceptable divergence. So that the US dominating everywhere is the norm, and if Russia tries to assert that it has always had vital interests in what happens in Ukraine, that is evil and illegitimate and must be resisted. But at the same time, of course, yes, I mean, the American elites are aware that the United States has a much smaller share of world GDP, as does the West in general, than it did 30 years ago, that China is now a superpower in its own right, that, as we saw in the rejection of sanctions against Russia, most of the world, even countries that want good relations with the US, like India, will not follow American orders. And so to the megalomania has been added an element of hysteria, of fear that America is losing this globally dominant position. And that seems simply psychologically unacceptable to the American establishment. The idea that America could step back, make compromises, allow, seek cooperation with other major powers, recognize elements of their vital interests, they just don't seem able to do that. You know, obviously the Trump administration couldn't do it, but leading elements of the Obama administration, not I think Obama himself, but obviously people like Hillary Clinton and Victoria Nuland, they couldn't do it. And Antony Blinken and Jake Sullivan certainly can't do it.
What is behind this? You said that the foreign policy establishment. Is it a matter of personnel? Are there interest groups driving this? Is it too cynical to point out that arms dealers are rolling in money?
Well, it's many elements. A very, not historically unique, but nonetheless unusual element is that provided by the Israel lobby. Because even if, well, as the previous generations of American diplomats pointed out, even if America is determined to exercise hegemony in the Middle East, blind allegiance to Israel is a crazy way of doing that. But beyond that, yes, the military-industrial complex plays a role. You see Raytheon's shares booming and Raytheon officials declaring, you know, hymns of joy over arms supplies to Ukraine and to Israel. But I think as well, every major country around the world with any kind of foreign security establishment has some form of foreign and security doctrine, which everybody who wants to be part of that establishment has to sign up to. And if you don't, if you dissent from it, you're kicked out. So, you know, you see that in China. The Chinese establishment believes that China has to return to its, of course, ancient role as a superpower, dominating its own region, and with major influence, not exclusive influence, but major influence on world affairs as a whole. If you don't believe that, you're not going to last long in the Chinese foreign security establishment. The Russian establishment believes in a multipolar world in which Moscow will be one of the poles. I mean, only one. They know that America will always be a pole, China will be a pole, India in future will be more and more of a pole. But Moscow must be a pole, and Russia must be in a position to defend its vital interests on the territory of the former Soviet Union. Once again, if you dissent from that, you better start looking for another job outside the Russian establishment. And the American foreign security establishment has a doctrine, but the problem is that this doctrine is essentially a megalomaniac one. It is one greater than any country, even in a way the Roman and Chinese empires, which at least confined themselves, well, they had to their own regions and didn't try to dominate the whole world. The British Empire dominated large parts of the world, but from early on it knew that it couldn't take on the United States, and it knew that it couldn't actually unilaterally do anything on the continent of Europe. It's really only America that has believed that it both can and should dominate the whole of the world. But you have to believe that if you're going to get ahead, get to the top of the American system.
Okay, let's do some detailed looks here. Ukraine first. In some circles, you can get in trouble for pointing to a U.S. role in provoking the invasion of Ukraine, but you can't really understand the whole crisis, much less think about solving it without conceding that. Is that possible?
I mean, it is possible, because after all, you have a lot of highly intelligent American commentators and some Brits who have been saying just that. Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer, very distinguished retired American diplomats, Jack Matlock, Tom Pickering, of course, the great George Kennan, the late George Kennan. So many people have said this. But ever since the expansion of NATO became a bipartisan matter in the mid-1990s, essentially anyone with a career to make has fallen into line behind this idea that NATO, of course, under US domination, must be the only security institution on the European continent with the right to dictate the terms of European security to everybody else, and that Russia has no security role beyond its own borders. And that, you know, as once again people have been warning for 30 years now, was bound to lead, if not to actual war with Russia, although the CIA warned of war with Russia in Ukraine in the mid-90s. And of course, the present director of the CIA, William Burns, warned in 2008 that NATO membership for Ukraine is the reddest of all Russian red lines, and that the whole of the Russian establishment is violently opposed to it. That is not an excuse for Putin's invasion. And indeed, in private, a lot of Russians who regard themselves as Russian patriots and are now committed to at least avoiding defeat in Ukraine, in private and sometimes in public, candidly admit that the invasion was a disaster from every point of view. But it was not, unlike what you read so many people saying, it was not the act of some crazed maniac. It stemmed from a view of Russian vital interests that is shared by the whole of the Russian establishment, and that we set out to violate.
What is the U.S. goal here? Withdrawal of Russian troops? Total collapse of Russia? Ukraine is looking weaker and weaker on the battlefield, making it harder to extract concessions from Putin at this point. So where is this all leading?
Part of the problem is that, as indeed General Milley, amongst others, has hinted, and I think this is quite a general view in the Pentagon and possibly even in the CIA, we blew the chance for compromise with Russia on much better terms for Ukraine twice. The first was at the very start of the war, when Russia and Ukraine were negotiating a compromise peace. This has been almost totally forgotten, but in the first month of the war, Zelensky in public said the following: "Before the war, I went to every major NATO capital, including Washington, and I asked, can you guarantee that within 5 years, Ukraine will be admitted into NATO? And they all said no. Zelensky then said publicly to the Ukrainian people, well, at that point, we might as well have a treaty of neutrality with Russia, with, of course, international guarantees. And the territorial issues on much better terms for Ukraine would be shelved until future negotiation. But of course, for whatever set of reasons, but it does look as if the West played a major part, that process was abandoned. The second chance was in the autumn of that year, of 2022, when the Russians had suffered a series of really major defeats and might have been willing to accept a compromise. A compromise, I mean, one that would not have involved Russian withdrawal from Crimea and the eastern Donbass, but could have involved Russian withdrawal from other areas and a treaty of neutrality, but with really strong guarantees for Ukraine. But we didn't take up that possibility. And now, as you say, Russia is in a much stronger position. The Russians certainly feel that time is on their side. And if you look at European election results and opinion polls, it is extremely unlikely. Well, the German government has said this, that European aid can remain at anything like the present level for many years to come. And if European aid diminishes, well, then two things will happen. Either the US president will have to go to the US Congress and ask for much, much more money indefinitely for Ukraine. Or, of course, Ukraine will collapse. Or we will have to seek a compromise peace with Russia. Up to now, I mean, you have leaks, you have suggestions in public, you have hints, but no Western leader and precious few establishment commentators have had the guts to come out and say publicly, look, you know, our previous demand for total Russian withdrawal from Ukraine is over. That's not going to happen. The only chance to preserve most of Ukraine is to seek a compromise.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute. China, which is a growing adversary, though somewhat eclipsed by all the hot wars right now. Well, what is the goal there? Some kind of containment to reverse China's rise as a global competitor? That seems doomed, which isn't to say they wouldn't pursue the strategy anyway, but what are they trying to accomplish with China?
It seems that they are trying to contain China, both geopolitically and economically. I mean, essentially, to trap China at about its existing level of development, but without this leading to actual war. And that's, well, A, I don't think that's going to work, because, of course, all development is not just absolute, it's relative. And while China is obviously not growing nearly as fast as it did for most of the past 40 years, it's still growing faster than the US and a lot faster than Europe, which means that the West as a whole is still relatively declining. So this makes the whole relationship with China totally different from the US rivalry with the Soviet Union, which obviously was in no sense an economically dynamic power as China is. And also, of course, in the wider world, the US could appeal to elites all over the world who were afraid, often with good reason, of Soviet communism, appeal to religious elites against, you know, Soviet communist atheism. It could even appeal, you know, to social democrats who were afraid of Stalinism. But of course, China doesn't pose that threat at all. Despite all these attempts to talk about, you know, an axis of authoritarianism and China spreading its model, it isn't. China has established a model, and people can follow it if they wish to do so. But there is no evidence of China trying through subversion or pressure to get Brazil to go back to dictatorship, or Thailand to get rid of its monarchy. No, I mean, there's none of that. And so, of course, most countries around the world do not want to choose between the US and China and react very badly to US attempts to force them to choose.
Well, if you're talking about trying to contain China's economic and political rise, the name King Canute comes to mind.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But now, Israel's rampage. Mouin Roubini said recently that people aren't suffering from outrage fatigue over the warmongering because Israel keeps upping the ante of horrors. It does seem that way. And now, at first, U.S. support seemed reflexive, almost atavistic. But is something else going on? I've been seeing such suggestions lately that Biden's inner circle is actually enthusiastic about remaking the Middle East, which sounds suspiciously like what Bush and Cheney and the neocons were saying a couple of decades ago. How do you see this support? Is it just that atavism, or is there some grander imperial design behind it?
In the wider U.S. establishment, it is a mixture of atavism and, let's face it, fear. Personal fear of the personal consequences if you speak out against Israel. Within circles of the establishment, I mean, this is open now on the part of the neoconservatives and others. And of course, the neoconservatives have now moved back where they first came from 60 years ago into the Democratic Party. Well, you see this with Cheney supporting Biden. You see this with Kagan and Frum and all the others, you know, now supporting Biden. Yes, I mean, I think that there is now a hope of, not in the same way, because I don't think anyone is talking about invading Iran, but basically doing to Iran, you know, what the Bush administration did to Iraq, crippling it or even destroying it, breaking it up as a functioning state, and thereby eliminating the last state in the Middle East, which is openly and determinedly hostile to both the US and Israel. I mean, at that point, all you would have left is, well, Syria under Russian protection, as long as the Russians hang on there, and then a collection of US client states which will complain and make speeches in the UN, like Jordan. The King of Jordan will bitterly denounce Israel in the UN while allowing US missiles to be based on his soil to shoot down, you know, missiles attacking Israel. And then, you know, from the Israeli and much of the US establishment point of view, America and Israel would simply have won. They would then dominate the Middle East for all foreseeable time. Except, of course, they wouldn't, because, you know, as we found in 2011, the peoples of the Middle East also, well, they didn't have a vote, of course, but they have the ability to come out and overthrow their regimes. And the kind of hegemony of which the neocons and parts of the US establishment in general are dreaming is, in my view, I mean, simply politically unsustainable for very long. Leaving aside, of course, the question which, frankly, I mean, is becoming simply a joke in the eyes of the vast majority of the world population, you know, that US global hegemony was supposed to have a certain moral base, liberal internationalism and all that. Well, liberal internationalism is dead in the ruins of Gaza.
There's this ridiculous charade of drawing red lines and then shrugging when they're crossed. Now it's over Israel's apparent attempt to starve people out of northern Gaza, but given the history, that looks like another game of charades. Israel is also dismembering Lebanon. There seems to be no limit to U.S. indulgence of Israel's ferocity. Is there one?
When it comes to Israel's treatment of its immediate neighbors, no, clearly there isn't. There are, however, two questions. The first is, just how far will Israel go, and would the US allow Israel to go in attacking Iran? As I've said, the neocons and parts of the establishment would like Israel to go all in an attack on Iran. But despite recent Israeli successes, it's questionable whether Israel can do that on its own, or whether the US would have to come in as well. And then, obviously, you are talking about a much bigger conflict with, and depending on how the Ukraine war goes and when it comes to an end, but you are most probably talking then about Russia and China really, not in war, but in funding and weapon supplies coming to Iran's help against the US as an obvious way of pushing back against US pressure on them in their own area. So that's the first question. Will the Israelis be confined to a limited strike on Iran, or will they go all in to try to destroy the Iranian economy, to destroy Iranian energy exports? And of course, if they do that, they could well produce a global economic crisis. It would certainly have higher energy prices, would have a terrible effect on Europe, but to some extent as well on the US public, which is one reason, I think, why nothing is likely to happen until after the US elections, because the last thing that the Biden and Harris teams want is a surge in US gasoline prices.
That'd be curtains for them. Yeah.
It would indeed. But what happens after the elections, we don't know. The second question, I think, and this is something that we now have to look at very seriously, if you listen to or watch, not just the more extreme elements in the Israeli cabinet are saying, but large sections of Israeli society and Israeli academia, which are not being reported, of course, by far the greater majority of the Western mainstream media, are now talking about ethnic cleansing, driving the Palestinians from large parts of Gaza and replacing them with Israeli settlers and annexing this area, and restricting the Palestinians more and more in the West Bank until large numbers of them leave, or even the idea of simply deporting them all, driving them out into Jordan. You know, you have this language in Israel about how Jordan is the homeland of the Palestinians and everything west of the Jordan is Israeli. Would the US go along with that? The thing about that is that if the Israelis did that, it could or even probably would bring down the existing Jordanian state and monarchy. If they drove the population of Gaza into Egypt, would the Egyptian regime survive? Well, at that point, you're talking about key US allies in the Middle East being destroyed by Israeli actions. Would the US go along with that? I mean, I would have thought that at that point there really would be some kind of pushback in the US establishment and the US military, but who knows?
Yeah, now to conclude this world tour, Biden is on the way out, and so let's talk about the two successors. What does Harris's foreign policy view look like? Does she have one other than more of the same? I mean, the way she's been recruiting neocons to her campaign, it looks like it's not just electoral arithmetic trying to get all those Republican voters, but it does seem to reflect some of her thinking. What do you make of it?
Yes, I mean, well, I think it will be either more of the same or it will be worse. We have to see who makes up Harris's team. We just don't know. People talk about Phil Gordon And he is certainly a moderate and has very close European contacts and affinities. But, you know, as with Obama, you could find a Secretary of State, like Liz Cheney, God forbid, who would simply ignore the wishes of other members of the cabinet and drive a neocon agenda. And since Harris clearly is absolutely ignorant of international affairs, hopelessly so, one can well imagine that a determined enough team of neocons could make US policy much worse. I certainly don't think there's any chance of it being much better.
Trump. I mean, it's impossible to predict anything about that guy. He's so impulsive and shallow, but there are some people who view him as a peace candidate of sorts. Is there any truth to that?
Trump does appear to have understood that the American people do not want more wars with American troops actually being involved and killed on the ground. And, of course, his vice president, you know, Vance, did lead the charge in Congress against unlimited and indefinite funding for Ukraine. And on Ukraine, I mean, Trump has said that he will seek a peace settlement. And given that so much of what's happening on the ground is heading in that direction anyway, I think there is some chance of that. But of course, in the Middle East, he is just as absolutely pro-Israel as the Biden administration and could be, you know, even more unhinged when it comes to an attack on Iran. The only hopeful thing is that, you know, in the past, we've seen again and again, for example, with regard to North Korea, that Trump will make these ferocious trumpeting statements and then not actually do anything about it. And then there's China. The only thing to be said for the Biden administration is that it does seem to have been aware most of the time, not always, of the extreme delicacy of this situation. So when Pelosi insisted on going to Taiwan, this was not something that Biden wanted. Well, delicacy and Trump are not words that go very well together. But once again, it'll depend on, you know, who he chooses as his Secretary of State. It will depend on how much influence Vance has within the administration. It will depend on all these things that we just don't know. I have to say, I mean, it's a damned odd picture for democracy. You have a series of issues which are involving the US public in enormous costs, hugely high spending coming out ultimately of taxes. You've got issues which, in the worst case scenario, could actually lead to the nuclear annihilation of the United States, or at the least of you know, crises that would bring the entire world economy and the US economy down in ruins. And the US public have not actually been told what either of these candidates would do. This isn't a pretty picture as far as democracy is concerned.
It's always, not to mention the general devolution of our political class, what it's like to live in a declining empire, one unable to face its own decline graciously. It just seems like the level of chaos and violence seems like a product of decay.
When I was born, Eisenhower was still just president of the United States. And, you know, Ike, with all his faults, was a great man, very thoughtful leader. And now we have Trump and Harris. But of course, this is 64 years on. And I mean, when you think about it, 64 years is longer than the time that separated Bismarck from Hitler, or Marcus Aurelius from one of the more decadent and loathsome Roman 3rd century emperors. A lot can happen in three generations, and a lot of decadence and decline can happen during that time.
That was Anatole Levin, director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. was one of the loud portions of the third movement of Dmitri Shostakovich's marvelous Fourth Symphony, performed by the Philadelphia Orchestra under Eugene Ormandy. Shostakovich wrote the symphony in 1936 when Stalin was about to throw him into the doghouse for composing music that, as a commentary in Pravda put it, was bourgeois, coarse, and vulgar. Nervous, convulsive, and spasmodic music that reeked of Western modernism and not proper socialist realism. It was not premiered until 1961, well into the post-Stalin thaw. Next, the emptying out of the Balkans. People are leaving that part of the world in droves. Rural villages have turned into ghost towns, and smaller cities are losing population. Few areas of the world can rival it for population loss. The stories sound like those told about the American Rust Belt, despair and abandonment. My next guest, Lily Lynch, has a piece in the Baffler magazine website that looks into the phenomenon. In the years after the fall of communism, there was a lot of hope among both residents of the Balkans and bourgeois ideologists abroad that the transition to capitalism would unleash a dynamism that would bring this historically left-behind region up to Western European snuff. As with some of the former Soviet republics, that just hasn't happened. What happened, in fact, is quite the opposite. Lily Lynch is a writer, originally from California, who lived in the Balkans for many years. She's now in Istanbul. Besides the Baffler, her journalism has appeared in New Left Review and the New Statesman. She's a fellow at the Alameda Institute, as are many Behind the News guests I discovered looking over their website. Lily Lynch. The Balkans are emptying out, villages turning into ghost town, half the population of Bosnia and Albania living abroad. What's going on?
It's a complex problem, but it's a very real problem. And I wish that that was an exaggeration, what you just described, but it's really not. As an overview, I would say that it's the economy, the enormous disparity in average salary between the West and the Balkans. Unemployment is another one. Unemployment's pretty high. Youth unemployment is particularly high in Bosnia, I think in Kosovo, although it's come down in the last couple of years. So when you have relatively easy freedom of movement and the pull factor of having much better life opportunities somewhere else, makes total sense, and we shouldn't be surprised at all that people would want to do well for themselves, as you know, any of us would want to do that. So that's a big one. I think the economy is a big one. I think also the Balkans these days, and I'm kind of been talking mostly about the last like 10 to 15 years, have just kind of gotten, I mean, okay, I'm talking mostly about former Yugoslavia, although Albania also is similar, but I think in Albania it's been kind of consistently bleak. In the former Yugoslavia, you know, the last 15 years, there's just been like a kind of erosion of any positive vision for the future. Oddly enough, you would find people, and I certainly found people in Sarajevo and in Belgrade, who would say that like in the early 2000s, that they were actually very hopeful, even though they just, people had lived through a horrible war and you know, horrible atrocities, the worst in Europe since World War II. They still felt that like a new society could be built because there was peace. And I don't think any of that hope really exists now. I mean, maybe there are tiny pockets of it, but it's not. It's very muted. And for a lot of people, the idea of ideal for the future was joining the EU. That's no longer a credible possibility for people in the Balkans. That was a possibility probably until around the time of Brexit and the migrant crisis, and then internal crises within the EU made the EU lose appetite for enlargement. We don't want to enlarge. And so for most governments and for a lot of people, this idea of like, okay, well, we're going to be normal. We're all going to be in a quote unquote normal country, which is a political term in Serbia. But they were thinking that their future was in the EU. And now that's not going to happen. So like, what do we do? And the political culture as well is also pretty hopeless. There's some slight differences between countries, but in general, these are very corrupt governments. In the case of Serbia and perhaps Albania to a lesser extent, you have some kind of autocratic tendencies, kind of authoritarian neoliberalism, and these guys are very heavily backed by the West. So I think that there's just a general sense of hopelessness and despair. On the political level, maybe 25 years ago, when there was a similar kind of autocratic situation in Serbia, for example, people thought the West supported democracy. Of course, our government is always talking about how they support democracy against autocracy, but that's actually not true. They prop up autocrats. And so when I hear that framing, I always laugh. Pollution's gotten worse in the last, say, 5-10 years. Belgrade, Sarajevo, Zagreb, Skopje all top the most polluted cities in the world in winter. Corruption in all segments of society, from healthcare to politics. Sorry, this sounds so depressing, but it is a bit despairing and hopeless.
Well, it's interesting that countries in the former communist East to the north, you know, Poland and Hungary, are not doing anywhere near as badly. What is it about the Balkans?
That's a really good question. I mean, I would be tempted to say, and I think that a lot of people would say, oh, look at the benefits of the EU. Then I would say, look at Croatia. And Croatia is also experiencing the same mass exodus of its people. Croatia was the last country to join the EU over a decade ago. Some people would claim that it's the EU that is going to improve people's lives. And I'm not saying that there aren't positives that go along with EU membership. I'm sure that there are some. This is a different problem. The countries in Northeastern Europe, as you pointed out, didn't have a brutal war. They had a peaceful, quote-unquote, transition, no matter how brutalizing the neoliberal shock therapy was. They didn't have a war where, like, hundreds of thousands of people were killed. The Balkans were starting from a much more devastated place.
Yeah, I remember Slavoj Žižek, back before he became a professional comedian, mockingly talking about the dark and mysterious Balkans. But I think a lot of people in the West do view it that way, don't they?
Definitely, yes. I mean, it was a really good imitation of Žižek. I felt like I was talking to him for a second. I mean, certainly people in the West definitely view the Balkans that way. I mean, it's kind of funny for me because to me, it's sort of like a second home, so I don't have that. But I can see why, when I read reporting from the region still, I think that there's a tendency to kind of fall back on certain quote-unquote tropes. The 90s produced many, but of course it didn't start there. You have like British travelogues from the 19th century of people traveling through the Balkans and of describing them in this, with Orientalist cliches and so forth.
You note that the fertility rates have collapsed and that traditionalist reactionaries in the West celebrate the region as a place of old values where men are men and women obey, but that has not turned out to be the case, has it?
Not at all. Yeah. I mean, the Balkans are experiencing a similar fertility crisis as, like, Western Europe, and perhaps even in some countries even more significant. So yeah, you do have this kind of bizarre coexistence of the sort of fantasy of, like, the Slavic woman, the ultimate wife, like traditional wife. But the reality is that I think women have very few kids. I don't know too many people who have more than one sibling. And this is true even in communism, actually, not just now, but even though the numbers of children are, like, much lower than they were in communism. In like 75 years, I think Serbia, Bosnia, and North Macedonia are all going to have below one replacements, like 0.8 children per woman. So it's really, in some countries, it's really dramatic. In Albania, people are having like a quarter of the number of children they were in communism 30, 40 years ago. Yeah, it's quite striking. And we can argue what that's about, but it's certainly something that exists across the world. I think that it's probably informed by similar things in the Balkans.
Now, this is also resulting in a labor shortage, and they're importing labor from places like Nepal, which is causing some social tensions, right?
Right. Yes. Now, this is a really interesting change and something that's quite new. The former Yugoslavia was always the sort of source country for labor, for guest workers going to Germany, going to other places in Western Europe. And now, because of this, like, emptying out of towns, Serbian government said a couple of years ago we're losing like a town, I think it's a town a day. So now there's a in order to kind of keep the society running, they are importing people predominantly from Asia, and it's like definitely a visible change. A Serbian bus driver, for example, can earn a lot more money driving a bus in Germany than they can in Serbia. So then you have Serbs going to drive buses in Germany, and then Nepalese people coming to Serbia to drive buses in Belgrade. Yeah, it's a very interesting change, and especially, because as I wrote in this article for The Baffler on this topic, very recently in our lifetime, in the 1990s, wars were fought for, sort of ethnically pure nation states. And now you have these countries dependent on foreign labor. And that's just going to become much more the case. We're just at the very beginning of it now.
Is there a nativist agitation going on?
To some extent, yes. I think in Croatia, it's been the most pronounced, but that's partly because Croatia has, you know, is in the EU. So a lot of people coming from, say, Nepal or Bangladesh see Croatia as an entrance point into the wider Schengen zone. Croatia just joined Schengen, which, you know, of course, allows you for freedom of movement within the EU. So, yeah, so Croatia's, and because I think that it's certain industries, that the health industry, they need so many people, that there's a lot of Nepalese in particular going to Croatia. And you see definitely a nativist kind of backlash among the Croatian far right, which in Croatia is a very, very kind of prominent mainstream discourse and mainstream politics. It's generally kind of a right-wing country. It was a big part of the recent election. You heard people making these, it's the usual discourse that we hear in the U.S. too, you know, about people, foreigners taking jobs and, you know, foreigners engaged in crime. And, you know, the reality is actually quite sad and different than that. The reporters have found, like, you know, 30 Nepalese people living in a single apartment in Zagreb. You know, like, really, it's more often the case that actually these people are being exploited. Nepalese, there were some employment agencies that were asking $7,000 in order for people to have, like, their visas processed and, like, to come to Croatia to work. Imagine paying $7,000 from coming from Nepal to just to go work in Croatia.
It must be hard to scrape together $7,000 in Nepal.
I mean, it sounds incredibly hard. It's hard to do in a lot of places. You know, it's hard to do in the West. So I can imagine it's almost impossible in Nepal. But these people are, yeah, they're being exploited.
I'm speaking with Lily Lynch, whose piece on the emptying out of the Balkans is on the Baffler magazine's website. There's a whole industry that's grown up tempting these people in the Balkans to go to, say, Britain, right?
Yeah, in particular, Albanians have been kind of recruited, and there's been a lot of recruitment via TikTok in particular. Part of this is some kind of, I don't know, like Albanian sort of influencer, cool guys with like nice cars and like hot girls, cool diaspora guys, I guess, in the UK who are making these videos. And like, of course, you're like a young guy in Albania, there's like no pathway to like a decent life. And so it was 2022, 12,000 Albanians crossed the English Channel on rubber boats, trying to just, I mean, it's shocking.
They're not exactly welcome with open arms.
No, I don't know. I just saw the Telegraph, I think it was last week, like published this like repulsive. Telegraph tries to pretend it's like a, like, I don't know, like kind of a respectable publication, right? I mean, and they were like, they had a table or like an article that was like it explained the nationalities that supposedly commit the most crimes, like by nationality. It was so repulsive. Yeah. Yeah. And Albanians were on the list for that. Like, I don't know, they're selling weed or something.
And then Serbia is experiencing an influx of refugees from Russia who are mostly what? Educated, urban, anti-Putin, yet Serbia itself is politically pro-Putin. Explain these contradictions here.
Yeah, though it's a fascinating kind of, I mean, you'd expect that there would be a clash between these two populations, but it's people are living in alternate universes side by side. So yeah, you have a very large number of Russians who've come from, like you said, anti-Putin Russians who are middle class, who earn a lot of money in tech for the most part. The numbers are difficult to come by because a lot of them like live in this gray area of legality where some of them go to the border with Bosnia and do a quote-unquote visa run. So they're allotted, I think, 30 days visa-free, and so they go to their border, turn around, and re-enter Serbia. So those are people who may be not counted officially, right? Like, so we don't know. I've heard numbers from, like, 250,000 to, like, 370,000, so it's really, we don't know for sure, but it's a lot, and it's a very visible new community. Serbia is, like, there's no question that it's sort of the most like sympathetic to Russia in Europe. Like, and you can, it's something invisible that you see. You'll see Z graffiti everywhere in Serbian cities. You see like, you know, there's like Putin t-shirts for sale and Putin coffee mugs. I always joke about this because I think people derive, like, they kind of like see a coffee mug and they like decide that they understand the country's like kind of complicated foreign policy and history. Yes, you had this sort of like, I would say kind of Putin, it's wrong to say overtly Putinist. It's like the Serbian public is overtly Putinist. They're extremely skeptical of the West. That's absolutely true.
Well, I mean, they've been bombed by NATO. They must feel that.
Right. That's where it comes from. And I think that even maybe preceding that, there's a sense that Belgrade has always sort of had this sort of sense of being between the empires, you know, even going back before the non-aligned movement. Belgrade was where the first summit was held, the non-aligned movement. And so, yeah, there's a sort of sense of sort of like neutrality as part of, almost part of the country's like identity or the foreign policy identity. But that's all said, there is more sympathy for Russia than you'd think. And so it's been very interesting to see this large number of immigrants from Russia come to Serbia and, like, you know, kind of be confronted with this, like, Z graffiti and, like, you know, very sort of aggressively anti-West. Because, again, these are, like, you know, kind of, like, liberal anti-Putin Russians. So, though, you know, in the beginning when the Russians started coming, and they came, by the way, because, of course, we know that European countries closed their borders and closed their airspace to Russians, even Russians fleeing war, which I always thought was a very odd choice, because why wouldn't you welcome people who didn't want to fight for Putin's war, right? Like, I mean, if you really are opposed to it. But anyway, and it was also kind of like, to me, had a bit of a overtly sort of nationalist feeling to it, quality to it. So the only countries in Europe where Russians can come are Serbia and Turkey. Both countries still have direct flights to Russia and allow Russians to enter without a visa. So these are places where a lot of Russians have gone. So yeah, so you have, there in the beginning, when this all started in early 2022, I remember a lot of liberal commentators and, say, some like journalists were hoping that the Russian immigrants would sort of like enlighten, quote unquote, enlighten the Serbs as to like the realities of Russia. And, you know, Serbs are just extremely skeptical of like sort of any story. And I think that, you know, goes for like any kind of story, whether from the kind of pro-Putin Russian side or anti-Putin Russian side, is still a little laced with skepticism, the response to that. So, yeah, no, that hasn't happened. And actually, there are some exceptions, but overwhelmingly, the sort of Russian immigrants live in a sort of parallel society. I'm also an outsider, so when I lived in Belgrade, I sort of appreciated this new life that they brought, you know, this like new energy and new businesses. And like, of course, there were negatives. The rents went skyrocketing, doubled. That trend was starting before they came, though. I should emphasize that the rents were rising after COVID. But the rents really went, you know, kind of crazy, unlike anything I've ever seen, because Russians, they had much more money than local Serbs. So they could pay for a year of rent in advance, you know, in cash and like easily. And like, you know, that's not going to, most people living in Belgrade before that, you know, couldn't do that. And so it was a huge, like, kind of a change for Belgrade, for Novi Sad. These Serbian cities have received a lot of Russians. And I think that there have been really positive things about it too. Again, like new bars, like some new cultural life, like, you know, festivals and music events. But in general, it kind of makes sense. Russians have their own tastes and their own language, you know, concerns, and that's been kind of separate from Serbia's. And I think a lot of people have sort of realized, like, oh, we're not quite as similar as we thought we were. I mean, in some ways, they really are, but culturally, there are really striking differences. And I've heard that from a few people, like, we thought the Russians were, you know, just like us, but no, no, they're not. So,
finally, at the end of your piece in the Baffler, you say territories for which wars were fought, regions that were cleansed in the name of ethnic purity, are now being emptied of their people. Only a few decades ago, nationalists fought and died for the dream of a homogenous nation states, and today their countries require mass in-migration of foreign workers to sustain their existence. That really sounds at once paradoxical, but really pretty depressing.
It is. You know, it is. I mean, there's just kind of not, like, it's just a fact, you know. This is what's happening. I close the piece with this, which I say that there's, like, a silver lining to that. If there could be any silver lining, because I'm always asked, you know, will there be a new war in the Balkans and when? And, like, and I say no. There will be eventually, because it's sort of a cyclical there are cyclical wars in the Balkans that happens happening for a very long time. But the reality is, in terms of like the now, like immediate in the next couple of years, like how? Who is going to fight that war? This is not the late 80s or early 90s where people like, you know, are all very kind of filled with nationalists, like kind of romantic nationalist ideals about, you know, wanting to have an ethnically pure nation state. Nationalism is still very, very strong in the Balkans. But people have, for the most part, achieved their goal. They've gotten their own countries. First of all, just the demographics are not in favor of war because there's not very many young people left. The demographics are very old. So you don't have this sort of like youthful energy, but maybe the exception of Kosovo. People see, when they think about their future, someone who's sort of like very, I don't know, has a strong will to like, you know, to sort of do well for themselves is probably thinking about leaving the country. Actually, I think it's 71% of people between 18 and 24 in the Balkans are thinking of leaving. If a war starts or if a draft starts, people are going to be leaving. Like it's if they aren't already gone.
They can hire Nepalese mercenaries to fight.
I was thinking of that. I was like, yeah, I mean, we were talking about like yeah, Nepalese people driving buses, but are they going to have like militaries full of foreigners? I mean, it's insane.
That was Lily Lynch. Her article, Go West, is on the Baffler's website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the conclusion of Shostakovich's Fourth Symphony, performed by Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra. Till next week, bye.